I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. At the end of a week of tumultuous breaking news and images from the war in Iraq, we're taking a deep breath and stepping back for a moment to consider a different time and place, and a different war. The takeover of Cambodia by the Khmer Rouge is a story few in the West hold vividly in memory. That revolution was barely televised. But reading the pages of The Gate, a stunning new memoir by French ethnologist François Bizot, the random cruelty and death of that time seems strangely familiar today. What war does to the people caught up in it, and the echoes that remain decades later, is a universal and recurring story. And Bizot, who spent months chained to a tree on orders from the Khmer Rouge, only to have his life mysteriously spared, makes it all too real. At the center of his story is an unlikely friendship with his captor, a former schoolteacher named Duit, who saved Bizot and then went on to become one of the primary architects of the Cambodian genocide. Connection listeners, The Gate is a memoir of survival during a time of war and of death. What does the story of genocide reveal about society and about the capacity of individuals for compassion and for cruelty? Join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. François Bizot is with me in the studio today to tell us more about a book which writer Jean Le Carré calls an original classic. Welcome.
Thank you very
Monsieur
much.
Bizot. You know, the kinds of things that you write about are the sort of events that most of us might prefer to forget. Perhaps you would have had as well. And in fact, you say that you wrote it in a bitterness that knows no limit. I'm wondering if one of the reasons why you wrote it was to get some of those memories out of your head and down onto the page and perhaps in some way to exercise them.
Well, when I started to write the book, I did not really question myself why I was doing that. But it just suddenly happens in my life when I receive a telephone call from Cambodia by an American journalist, and he said, just like that, Duit is in front of me. He called you his friend, and he said, Bizot will be happy to know that I have changed my ID.
And will you explain who Duit is?
Duit was the director of the camp in which I have been chained for 3 months in the forest in the north, 150 kilometers in the north of Phnom Penh in Cambodia. And when I met for the first time this Khmer Rouge, this revolutionary Khmer Rouge, he seems to me as a fairly young, sympathetic guy. And I did not realize, in fact, he was in charge of the camp, in charge of my life. He could decide the moment when I should be killed. And because it was not a question about the end of my presence over there, everybody who entered in that camp has to be killed.
Let me interrupt you for one moment, because I want to take you back to the phone call that you were telling us about receiving, and Duit saying that you were his friend. Did you view him as a friend?
No, not at all. In fact, I was and I still be in this delicate and very awful situation to own my life to a monster. It would never help him very much, I suppose, to know that there is only one person that for him was good enough to, through his cliché, was good enough to be spared, you know.
But at the time, you did not view him as a monster, as you were just saying, or
yes,
did you?
No, well, it started already, you see. But, in fact, he was 25, 7, and I was 30, and going through interrogation that he was doing with me, he asked me a lot of questions because he was sure that I was a CIA agent, and he just want to make the report of my confession before to kill me, as it was always. I don't really understand why, but it is like that. Before killing enemy, you have to make them to speak and to make you more comfortable, maybe, and to be able to kill you in with a reason, you know.
What were you doing in Cambodia? You came there as a young man in 1965,
I
believe.
Yes, I was sent over there to study Buddhism. I was a young ethnologist, and I was sent by the director of my thesis to go there and to start a research and a study of Cambodian Buddhism, which was not well known at that time.
But because you were a Westerner, the immediate assumption was that you were a spy? That was why you were captured by the Khmer Rouge?
It was a sort of paranoia about CIA and the enemy of people, you know. And so as far as I was myself a foreigner, they could not believe a foreigner could be sent by his country in Cambodia just to study Buddhism. So he asked me a lot of questions about that. And I had to try to show him the interest of my research. And doing so, I asked him question back. And he replied, because he was not a brutal person. He was more clever than brutal. And he tried to gain my confidence to make me speak better than just to beat me first, you know. So we speak. I ask a question back. He answered to my question. And little by little, weeks by weeks, we became more nearer one to each other. And the funny thing is that he started to believe that I was not CIA. In fact, this young revolutionary was a Nihilist. And in that way, he resembled to a lot of friends that I have in Paris, in France. He was generous, like them. He was convinced of the misery around him. He wanted justice. He hated the difficulty that every person has in the society, and he wanted to change that society.
Can you paint a picture for us of what this camp looked like? You describe it so vividly in the book. Give us a word picture here of where it was. Was this in the middle of the jungle? You were chained to a tree in this place. Was it a big area?
It was not a big area. It was in the middle of a mixed forest on the Piedmont, on the base, on the start of a hill, which was near a small village, a big village, let's say, which was called Om Liang. And that mountain was a part of the cardamom chain in Cambodia. And at that time of the year, that was just the ending of the rainy season, and it was quite cold at night. Not much, but let's say 12 or, you know, 30 degrees. And, I did not really know when I just came in the camp that it was 50 other prisoners, because that was a very quiet place. You are not allowed to speak, not allowed to move. And, I just arrived in that camp. But as far as I can remember, my souvenir over there was the sound of the forest and the changing of the color of the sky every time, you know. And it makes me very much to be able to have sometimes some pleasure to look around and to listen to the forest.
You write about a little girl who was brought to the camp who, with her father, the father was executed. You tried to befriend her. sent her over milk and sugar, and in many ways felt that that she did warm to you at one point. There is a description in your book, I wonder if you would read it for us, about what happened one remarkable day with this little girl.
Yes. This little girl, in fact, reminded me my daughter, who was with me when I was caught, and would stay in a village by herself. And I was very, very, it was very difficult for me to think about her because I was afraid of everything, you know, for her. So when I saw this little girl, it was, she reminded me of my daughter. And when I was unchained, at the end of the day, the girl followed me as far as the river before returning to her shelter to sleep. In the morning, very early, she was back again. The sight of this child who was under my protection filled me with immense courage. After a few days, she was invited to participate in maintenance jobs, working under one of the leaders, a reserve young man, about 20 years old, whom we saw very seldom. She took part in the self-reproach session, which began with singing. Silent as ever and looking lonely, she joined in without thinking, clapping her hands along with the others. The small community of young peasants in charge of us was opening up to her. The soft noises of the camp floated on the evening air as my guard mechanically locked the chain that gripped my foot. I changed legs each time, taking care to make my ankle budge so the ring should have some play. My little protégé arrived, as she sometimes liked to do at dusk. I saw her approaching, floating along like a butterfly, her camera billowing in the light of a bright patch of sky. She squatted down on her hand, sought my drawn-up leg. Her delicate forefinger, I can still remember its transparent, fragile nail, slipped easily beneath the iron links, which she solemnly lifted to gauge the tightness. The touch of this finger on my bruised skin did me good. Moved by her concern, I quickly did my best to minimize the pain caused by the iron around my ankles by nodding my head in a gesture of denial and smiling reassurance. She skipped away and returned with a bunch of keys in her hand. I looked at her in astonishment. She unlocked the padlock and, with some difficulty, carefully retightened the chain.
This is The Connection on NPR. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're speaking with François Bizot this hour. He holds the chair in Southeast Asian Buddhism at the Sorbonne. He has also written a new book called The Gate. His story takes place in the 1970s in Cambodia as the Khmer Rouge came to power. Connection listeners, what does genocide tell us about society as a whole? What does it teach us about the limits of compassion and the excesses of cruelty? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That is 1-800-423-TALK. And just before we were taking a break, we were listening to an excerpt from this book. And Connection listeners, I also wanted to let you know that you can read the first chapter of François Bizot's The Gate on our website. That's theconnection.org. Francois, I want to come back to the story of this little girl because it is so compelling as you're reading it, as a reader, and you're thinking, oh, this little girl whom you had befriended is going to do something lovely. And in fact, she winds up tightening the chain on your leg, which you had gone to such great lengths to try to make as comfortable as you could. Did she suddenly start to think of you as the enemy? What was happening there?
Maybe, yes. Well, you know, it's very easy to make somebody to change his mind, especially for young person, young girl, young boy. And the best food for revolution are the youngest. It's obvious. In any situation of drama or war, the younger are the better. Well, in fact, there is not really. I feel terrible, because, in fact, in that part I read, maybe we don't understand that for days and days she did not want to eat anymore, and she was really, you know, as someone who just want to stop to live. And it happened that my effort to give her milk sugar, the two things that it happens that I had, make her just a little bit more comfortable, and she start to open her eyes around, and little by little she life gained her again. And when I saw that she tightened my chain, it was a sad remembrance of what it can be in life. In fact, it is more a symbol of my sadness than the reality, because this kind of reality, you can find that everywhere.
What finally happened to her?
I don't know. But certainly, you can guess, she became a young revolutionary, Khmer Rouge. It was a lot of girls too in the forest to fight again imperialism, American, as they said, because they get the order to do that.
But you did see her later in the camp.
Yes, not much afterwards. Not much. It seems that, as you said before, I start to be an enemy for her.
I want to get back to the relationship you had with Dewitt and the intellectual discussions that you had with him in particular. He was a former math teacher, and in one of the passages in the book, you go into quite some detail about the comparisons between the demands of a utopian revolution, which apparently he felt that he was very much a part of, and also some religions which demand complete submission. And you make the point that perhaps because you had so much time to contemplate all of this as you were chained to your tree, you really gave these topics a great deal of thought.
Yes. In fact, the rules of the Khmer Rouge, seems to me that it was borrowed from the rules of Buddhism, as it was taught in Cambodia. And, of course, he denied that, and he hates for himself religion as a Marxist and a communist. He said it was the opium of people, you know, as it is well known. But the very funny part, and I think that is the reason why I want to write the book when I realize he is still alive. I thought he was dead. Then I remember that the young guy that I met was this kind of true, realistic, idealistic person. He was a truth seeker. And as he was very fond of truth, he hated lies. I had an ally. And I told him, if you don't believe me, who will? And it happens like that through his cliché about CIA that I did not fit to that those clichés. And he start to fight with his hierarchy, the high leader, above him to said, this Frenchman is not CIA. I don't want to kill somebody. You ask me to kill enemy of people, but I don't think he is. So I don't want to kill him. And that has been a big problem because Tamok, who was his direct chief, want absolutely that I was smashed like the others. And so that the story and my file goes up to Pol Pot himself, who just, why, I don't know, how can I know? He said, just relieve the Frenchman. And some years later, it happens that I go to Cambodia and see this terrible place of death, which is called the Thul Sleng jail prison. Maybe 20 or 30,000 people in this place has been tortured and killed. And I suddenly realized that the chief of the place, the president of the place who organized and makes things possible, you know, the arrival of prisoners by trucks, their torture, their confession, and then send them to the killing field, was Dutch himself, was this young, idealistic dreamer about good society. And that make me on this terrible situation that I realize that I knew a monster. And when that monster in the front of me dropped his mask, what I saw behind the mask was much more frightening than I would have thought, because what I saw was a man looking like us.
You write about what you saw with him. I wonder if you would read another section from your book about Dweet's explanation of why he did what he did. This was one of your many discussions about why you were there.
When I was unchained at the end of the day, I'm sorry, that was not the good one. Yes, I'm sorry. Most of the people who arrived here, he explained after a short silence, have been caught in the act of spying. It's my responsibility to interrogate them, to find out who their contacts are, what type of information they are looking for, and who's paying them. Just one of these traitors could jeopardize our world struggle. Do you think they are going to reveal what they know of their own free will? But who does the beating, I ask. Ah, he cut in. I cannot stand their duplicity. The only way is to terrorize them, isolate them, and starve them. It's very tough. I have to force myself. You cannot imagine how much their lying infuriates me. When I cross-examine them and they resort to every ruse to avoid talking, denying our senior officer potentially vital information, then I beat them. I beat them until I'm out of breath. The fire began to flicker. A sinister shadow slipped his face in two. I was frightened. I would never have believed that this mathematics teacher, this committed communist and conscious leader, could also be a henchman. Later, I often thought about this conversation, a dark revelation beneath a star of foreboding. That Christmas night, a huge part of my naivete crumbled. Up until then, I had been convinced by the resurging image of a brutal executor. Now the man of faith, staring ahead, of himself with an expression combining gloom and bitterness suddenly emerge in his immense solitude. Just as he revealed such cruelty, I surprised myself by feeling affectionate toward him. There was still generosity in him, perhaps the presence of a constant suffering, as visible in his posture of his face, is what held in me. Is what held me, I'm sorry. As I looked at him, tears came to my eyes. As if I were dealing with a dangerous predator, I could not bring myself to hate. But wasn't the danger simply the man within him? I was looking not at a monster from the abyss, but a human being, taken by nature to conditioned for killing, and conditioned for killing. His intelligence has been honed as the tooth of wolf or the shark, but his human psychology had been carefully preserved. Thus prepared, his master employed him as a kang in a vast timepiece beyond his comprehension.
You're listening to The Connection on NPR. And Connection listeners, if you're just joining us, what you have been listening to in these last few moments is François Bizot reading a selection from his new memoir, The Gate. And if you would like to read the first chapter of The Gate, you can go to our website, which is www.theconnection.org. You know, hearing all of this, it is such a remarkable story, François. And I have to wonder, why do you think Dewitt was so invested in keeping you alive? It certainly would have been easy for him to kill you if he had chosen.
Yes, he was a truth seeker. That was not his verity, his truth for him. And I suppose that he was a very good, terrible but good manager of the camp. And his superior knew that. And they may have think we use him very much. He is a good guy for us because he killed without asking question. And he believes in his aim. So now he ask, do not kill one man. We are not going to bargain. Maybe we just give him that, you know, to feed him, to have peace in himself. And today, I think he think about me as a sum of alibi, maybe, just to be confident in himself that he killed a lot of enemy of people. But when he meant once someone who were not, he just spared his life.
And also someone who could talk to him. I mean, I get an image almost of Scheherazade spinning out stories. You know, you were of intellectual interest to him. He was someone with whom he could argue and discuss and have conversation.
Yes, certainly. I think, you know, he called me his friend. I think it's by times, you know. It's an old story now, 30 years. Now he's 60. 61, I am 63, and when we look at each other, you know, it's not, he cannot see me, I cannot see him, we just see the past. And for him, as for everybody, we are defined by what we did. That's the goodness of youth, because everything is in front of us, and we can dream of about everything. But older time just give a limit to the dream, and you are only what you have done. And now he is a monster. He was not at start, but he act as a monster, and he became a monster. And That made me very sad. Is not to speak about his victim. His victims are very numerous. He recognized thousands and thousands of them. But they are dead. And unfortunately, if we could try to speak with the victim, with the dead person now, that would be very useful. But we cannot anymore. And that is all sadness about what it happens. But we have one. We have one killer. We have one monster. And I think it's very important to try to open our eyes and to just try to stop ourselves on that problem. And the terrible thing is, as when you look behind such a monster, you can see somebody who is looking like others, like yourself, you start to be afraid. But the funny thing is, you are not afraid of them, but you start to be afraid of yourself, of oneself.
And in fact, there was a moment where you said you understood that you could have been a torturer.
Certainly. Certainly I could. But I wonder if this gift would be given only for too few persons. I think we all, human beings, has been conditioned with very sharp teeth, like animals.
So in some level, we all have that capacity.
I suppose so. But we are in a bad position, according to animals. It seems to be a very painful accident of nature. Animals kills, their need to eat, their kills. There, but no problem for them. But when we are doing exactly like them, in the deepest part of ocean, we just feel responsible, and that is our terrible destiny.
We've been talking this hour with French ethnologist François Bizot. His new memoir is called The Gate. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're speaking with François Bizot this hour. He holds the chair in Southeast Asian Buddhism at the Sorbonne. He has also written a new memoir, The Gate. And you can join in the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to fast forward now. We've been speaking for most of the hour about your captivity at the hands of the Khmer Rouge for 3 months, and then the story moves fairly quickly from 1971 to 1975 in the story of Phnom Penh's fall. You were at the French embassy and in many ways had a very interesting relationship there as well. You were the only person who was allowed out, allowed in the street. How did that come about?
Well, I had this, already, this experience of the Khmer Rouge neologism and language, which was quite different of the average way of speaking in Cambodia. Revolution likes very much to change things, you know, and the language is the first things to be removed. So I was able to understand the special words of Khmer Rouge. And when the meeting with the Khmer Rouge in charge of the foreigners start with the French consul, and the French embassy was not anymore an embassy. It was a sort of a big foreign camp, you know, where every foreigner came. And so the discussion arose, and it was a few misunderstandings, and just by innocence of myself, I interfered in the discussion and said, maybe that was what you mean or what you meant. And they said, oh, yes, yes. And just at that moment, they only speak with me better than the other translator, who was a person who speaks very well Khmer, better than me, but he did not know the way of Khmer Rouge was using words.
And at that point, you had been speaking the language for what, about 10 years?
Yes, but especially 3 months with the Khmer Rouge gives me a very, very good lesson of language. And so I have been appointed, just like that, as the intermediary between Khmer Rouge, responsible Khmer Rouge of the French community, and the foreigner community. And I was effectively the only one to be allowed to go out and to fetch food or fetch everything, you know, just to try to help the community.
We have a caller who'd like to be part of the conversation now from Raleigh, North Carolina. David's phoning in. Hi, David.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a quick comment and essentially express admiration and applause for Mr. Bizot's efforts and his book and so forth. I intend to read it as soon as I possibly can. It simply strikes me in the current context of international occurrences, so to speak, that if people were a little more able to look inside themselves and understand that we all have that ability to be a torturer within ourselves, and understand that for what it is and accept it for what it is, it might give a lot more of us pause when we take up causes that include violence, such as going to war or taking up a cause that we have to do something violent against another person. I can only say that I think that works of this sort, if people will read them and will try to understand them, will only help mankind into trying to learn that lesson. It's a lesson that some people have been trying to learn for a long time, and I took up Buddhism myself about 2 years ago because of a search to understand anger within myself and to understand certain things along these lines, and so I'm gratified whenever I hear anything publicly represented to take this sort of an attitude, that self-reflection can help people to understand that we're all potentially that type of person. And Mr. Bizot, in not hating this individual that he dealt with who ended up being a torturer and so forth, and making the effort to understand the man, I think is a great testament to his humanity.
Thank you so much for the call, David. We appreciate it. Francois, has that been the general response as you have gone through France and now through the United States? Are people really seeing the parallels between today's newspaper and the story that you write?
It seems that it happens, that the connection is made between the actuality today and what happens in Cambodia and Vietnam. But if I may just react and give some understanding to what this gentleman said just before, I did not hate my torturer, but it is not really him. In fact, I could hate him easily. But it is the man in himself which, for whom I have deep sadness and sympathy, because I realize that he was very much responsible of what he did. There is no doubt about that. To try to understand is not to try to forgive. But the mechanism in him, I think that is the terrible part of what he is and he was. And then about the war in Vietnam and Indochina in general, with French, with other people, other countries who make war over there. You see the point when we maybe think that there is a line. Of course, there is a line which separates good and bad. But history told us, maybe, that there is no hope in trying to use this line to make in one side the bad one and the other side the good one out in the exterior of us and try to get rid of the bad just to keep the good one. It does not work. If it would have worked, we would know it since so much try we had made. But that line, in fact, which separate the good and the one and the bad, is not outside of us, and that makes things much more difficult. It is just the evidence we have to accept, to look on the ambiguity of the nature which is inside us, and the good and the bad. Man is able to love and to kill.
Let's go back to our phone lines for a moment. Anupam is calling from Lafayette, Louisiana. Hi, Anupam.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick statement, and then I'll ask my question, and then I'll disengage to listen to the response on the radio. I've been investigating the genocide that took place in Bangladesh, what was East Pakistan in that at that time in 1971. And 3 million lives were lost, and as I understand, almost 500,000 women were raped during that time frame. And this was one of the most concentrated acts of genocide that has taken place in human history, because over a period of 267 days, these 3 million lives were lost. Now, my experience in trying to generate some awareness among the community has met with two general responses. The first is basically incomprehension. And when confronted with the sheer enormity of 3 million lives lost at the hands of the army of what was at that time West Pakistan, people basically attempt to go into a denial mode. So one of the main responses that I've seen is incomprehension. And the second broad response that I have confronted is polite indifference. People will give you an audience because out of a sense of obligation, I think they will let you talk about it and they will let you express your thoughts. But essentially, their response stops there, which, like I said, is polite indifference. And I just wanted to ask your guest today, and perhaps even from your listenership, what have they experienced if they have sort of taken up an issue such as, which is so painful, actually, genocide? What has their experience been? And I'll disengage now and listen to the response on the radio. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks so much for the call, Anupam. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Francois, what about Anupam's point about the polite indifference? Can we really be indifferent to genocide?
Well, we are conditioned in one way to be indifferent in life and to everything around us. We don't want to look at death, and it's difficult to look at things around us. And I think all our history is based on genocide, mass murder, war, administrative crimes. And it's very difficult to take a good look of that, because it seems that the winner is always right. And sacrifice is always useless, except if you win.
I want to turn now to a story that you tell near the end of the book, when you go back to Cambodia years later, and there is a particular monk that you go to visit. If you would give us a line or two to tell us what we're hearing and then read it for us.
Yes, that was, I have been caught by the Khmer Rouge when I was going to meet an old man to ask him to help me to understand some text I was trying to translate and to understand. And when I arrived into the monastery, unfortunately, it was five Khmer Rouge, a group of milis who were there, but just by chance, and they caught me. And this old man was in my mind. And all the time I was chain in the Khmer Rouge camp, I think about this old man who seemed so embarrassed. And then afterwards, 30 years later, I meet the old man. Tahiyang suddenly rises from his bed, squinting in the daylight. The bonzes have deliberately woken him by talking rather loudly. When I see him more closely, a sort of fear grips me, for his uncovered body looks so withered that it is difficult to believe that there is still life within it. I come forward to explain who I am. The old monk admits that he does not remember anything. I listen to his answer with surprise, but no ill feeling, finding it comical that he should remember nothing of that grim meeting. Refusing to believe it possible that he could really have forgotten, Anne, who was a young Cambodian who helped me to go to this monastery, Anne tells the story again, mentioning that I had also come to interview two Arak singers, specialists of meditation rituals. The old man's eyes abruptly stop on me. A gentle glow comes over his soft wax face. His wrinkles come to life in a start of bewilderment. He has to be told several times who I am. The Frenchman of the Margosa, because I love to eat Margosa flower. And in his misty eyes, shining with a glaucous transparency, we see a glint of mounting surprise and happiness. Ha, Nyom Oi, that's 30 years ago. I have been waiting for this moment without ever believing it would come. I thought you were dead. When you walked in that day, my blood left me. You were speaking, and I did not dare say a word.
Thank you so much, François Bizot, author of The Gate. You can read excerpts on our website, theconnection.org. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon.